I think any pitch that doesn't have AI in it is just not going to get a look unless the team is incredible, but it'd be unlikely that an incredible team wouldn't be at least thinking about leveraging the newest, coolest technology, right? It's not necessarily AI. It's just like, it is that important that anybody who doesn't have, we joke about it internally, either the whole pitch is AI on every slide, like the ones I just talked about, or effectively like every part of it is AI.
Hi, I'm Boaz, founder and CEO of Simply Augmented, and I'm excited that you're tuning in to Shift AI, a show that explores what it takes to thrive and adapt to the changing workplace in the digital age of remote work and AI. In today's episode, I'm thrilled to have TA McCann as our guest. TA is managing partner at Pioneer Square Labs, and if you're someone interested in how AI is going to factor into the startup ecosystem, you won't want to miss this episode. It's great to have TA on our podcast, and we can't wait to learn more from him. Let's get to it. TA, good to have you on the show. It's good to see you. Thanks for being on.
I'm happy to be here.
So TA, I usually start these shows by reading back the guests' past experience, and you got a long one. So I'm going to read it back to you. And if I miss anything, you can tell me if I got anything wrong. Does that sound good?
Sure.
Okay, well, let's go back in time. So started off founder and CEO of HelpShare. And from there, 3 years at Microsoft, and then president of Mod Systems, did an entrepreneur in residence, Vulcan Capital, Polaris, then the founder of Jump2Go. That was around 2006 to 2008. And then when I first met you, you were the founder and CEO of Gist. And Gist got sold to BlackBerry. You became the VP of BBM for BlackBerry. And then there's lots of advisor roles and board roles that you've done over the years. I don't want to get into all of them. But then you were the founder of Rival IQ before now being the general partner, managing director of Pioneer Square Labs in Seattle, Washington. Now, there's one other thing that I forgot to mention that wasn't kind of part of the business resume, but the first time I ever heard you spoke about being on a boat and captaining a boat. And can you tell the audience a little bit about that and where that fit into the history?
Sure. Well, you got most of it right. Bunch of different highlights across that entrepreneurial journey. We certainly can go back to any of those if the accuracy is important.
Yeah, the accuracy is important. We'll go back to it.
But
yeah,
probably not.
Tell us about
it. Let's just say I've been doing entrepreneurship stuff for a while. So even going back a little bit further, I'm a mechanical engineer from Purdue. I grew up outside Chicago, living on Lake Michigan, and I grew up as a sailboat racer. And as a kid, I saw a video of a round-the-world sailboat race. And I sort of put on my list as a kid, I was probably 12 or 13, and I was like, ugh, like, I really want to do that thing. And I went, you know, I got to be a decent sailor in the Midwest on Lake Michigan. I got out of college as a mechanical engineer, built a bunch of robotic systems. And I wrote a letter to a couple people I'd met along the way who were very well-known professional sailors. And I said, hey, I'm, you know, these are my qualifications. I'm very interested in doing this round the world sailing race. Would you be open to giving me some advice, giving me some help, making some connections on my behalf? And I'd met them very briefly along the way. And they said, sure, just like you or I would do with a, you know, a young straight out of college person. Hey, I want to be an X. Can you give me some advice on that? And one thing led to another, and I got a tryout for an America's Cup team. I was like the last guy chosen, kind of put on the end of the bench, and one thing led to another, and we ultimately ended up winning the America's Cup. So in that, people who don't know, that's sort of one of the, you know, the most well-known sort of sailing, professional sailing competitions. And it's a little bit like being, you know, joining a company when it's relatively early as the person that's, you know, filling the cooler with sodas and then being there for the IPO. You know, you learn a tremendous amount along the way. You end up having that, you know, on your resume. And because you were there through that whole journey, it gives you opportunity to be and learn, meet other people in the space. So I did the 92 America's Cup, which we won. I then rinsed and repeated wanting to do the round the world race. So I did that in 93, 94. And then I did another America's Cup with Dennis Conner in 95, which we lost. And along the way, so this is 1995, the internet is starting to happen. and I'm like the technical guy on the boat. So because I was an engineer and I had a little bit of experience there, people would often ask me, hey, what's going on with this whole internet thing? And, you know, we're recording this in August 2023. It's not dissimilar from the way it feels with AI today. I imagine many of the people listening and yourself are kind of like you're sitting around a dinner table and people say, what's going on with this whole AI thing? Is this important and how would I apply it? And that was, you know, circa 1995 was the internet. And so I built a small consulting business building internet websites for everybody in the marine industry because nobody was building websites and certainly nobody was paying attention to the marine industry.
Oh, wow.
But I knew everybody in the marine industry and I was going to all these regattas and sailing and we'd sit around at night and drink beer and people would ask about the internet and I would go build websites for them. And that was the slow transition from sailing back into technology.
So you've been doing startups for a long time as an operator, and now you see a lot of deals come your way. You talk to a lot of founders, you help a lot of founders, you incubate businesses. What did sailing teach you about being an entrepreneur?
Well, I do have a fun talk that at least I like to give, which is how winning the America's Cup is like doing a successful startup. And so I do tend to draw some analogies between the two. And this will be more specifically about the America's Cup itself and technology startups. But number one is if you hire the right engineers and give them the right amount of resources, you can create technological advantage. And in the case of sailing, that equals boat speed. And obviously, we know what it means in the case of startups. Yeah. There is effectively a big Gantt chart, which is how much money do I have for how long and what are all the areas that I believe I can innovate? And those are true in sailing too. Should I build better masts or better boats or better sails or better training? There's lots of different ways that you can do that in an America's Cup context. Number three is, you know, you have a lot of sort of leadership dynamics of who's in charge of which particular thing and how does everybody integrate with each other on both a timeline as well as a thematic sort of, hey, we're going to innovate in category A or category B or category C. And if A, B, and C are competing with each other, it's not that useful. If A, B, and C are under aware of each other and they're sort of complementary of each other, and in certain cases, A and B combined to be a very significant innovation, quite similar to startups. And then I could tell lots of stories about, you know, massive failures along the way. So you this sort of, you know, awesome plan, hey, the America's Cup's in 2 years, we're going to have innovation in category A, B, and C, it's all going well. And then boom, like category B has a dramatic failure.
Yes.
And the thing you thought was going to happen isn't going to happen in that particular way. Do you stop in category B? Do you move the resources to category A and C? Do you say, okay, yep, big setback. Let's keep going because I really think there's something to be done here in category B. And that is true in both sailboat racing, but similar to something like Formula One, car racing has similarities to that. And for all of us who are startup-y people, there's lots of lessons in that.
Yeah, that's a good lesson.
So take one step back and sort of more the emotional side, especially when you're doing these long campaigns. They are a grind. I mean, America's Cup campaigns are 6 days a week or sometimes seven for months at a time from 6 a.m. until as late as you can at night. I mean, it is a full-on grind. And the people who can grind it better usually make more progress. The people who can stay motivated usually make more progress.
Better.
And when you now apply that into startups and you're trying to find this work-life balance or work-life integration and this sort of sprint, rest and recover sort of dynamic, there's a lot of similarities to that, you know, as well in between sailboat racing and startups. So those are a few ideas.
Yeah, those are awesome. So going back to the laundry list of experiences, you know, as you think back over the years, well, what did I get right? What do we need to correct in terms of accuracy? But what are the moments over the years as you think back now from the internet days that stand out for you?
Well, I think I'm not sure it'll be the internet days as much as maybe some of the lessons that have pulled forward through that entrepreneur experience that are now hopefully being somewhat productized at PSL. One is this ability to find and continue to work with amazing team members. So I'm still working with, so two of my companies were co-founded with my brother. So you have a tremendous amount of trust and understanding when you have, you know, a family relationship. My brother's very technical. My brother's incredibly smart. And he and I were really good at stay in your lane, do your part, trust in the other person. type of thing. So he was effectively a CTO while I was his CEO. I'm still working with the first hire that I had in 1999 from HelpShare, still works at PSL. I mean, this is like, you know, 20 years later, I'm still working with Adam Loving, who's incredible. And so if you're lucky enough to find people that you can really trust and also divide and conquer is a huge, huge benefit. And so as we're building these early teams at PSL, while you're doing it at an accelerated rate, you're really looking for who is highly complementary from a skills perspective, and how do you build sort of trust, understanding, and I'll call it stay in your lane-ness. And we found the companies that are best at PSL tend to have those types of attributes at the founding team level. I'd say second would be the speed of execution and shipping. And that's been true, you know, for all the different startups. Is like you can hypothesize a lot, you can pontificate a lot. Nothing stands the time of like ship. Just put it in the hands of customers and build and ship product. Third is asking for money. So a lot of times, especially if you're an engineer or a product person, you like building something that feels pretty cool, but you haven't thought enough about product and packaging, pricing, and asking for money. And that defines a lot of things. I mean, what will people actually pay for, and which feature A, B, or C is more valuable to those customers? Can you find consistency in those customers? And as I've gone through more and more startups, getting very good at this flow that we talk about here sometimes, which is ICP, VOC, EAC, ideal customer profiles, voice of customer interviews, and early adopter customers.
Got it.
And that's the simpler way to do it is ICP, VOC, EAC, and getting better and higher velocity, higher volume, and higher consistency through that certain funnel. If I look back on the companies that were more successful, they stayed pretty consistent in that, what is our hypothesis? Who are we selling it to? How do we get people through the funnel? And how do we continue to add value in an early adopter customer sort of way?
That's interesting. So I want to get deeper into the stuff you're doing at PSL. But before I do that, I want to go back and ask a personal question about your family. I recently had someone on the podcast who was one of your first employees, Shane Mack at Gist. And he described you as like one of the most disciplined people that he knows, and that he would get into the office and you'd already run a marathon by the time he you know, got in and was like starting to do work. And I just wonder, like, when you think back on your family and what your parents did for a living and how business was talked about at the dinner table, what did your parents do? And did business play a part and work play a part in the conversations that were happening when you were younger?
Well, my father was a salesperson for building products. So he ran international sales for a company called United States Gypsum, or USG, and they effectively invented sheetrock, as for any of us who are in the, you know, building trades. And so he traveled the world selling that product or selling those types of products. So from my dad's perspective, I think what I got was, you know, sales is important. And I got a broader world perspective, I think. You know, the world's a big place and there's lots of different kinds of people, and people who work for my dad would, you know, come and stay at the house. And so I knew people from other countries, and he would talk a lot about, you know, that type of thing. My mom was primarily looking after me and my brother. So I was primarily a stay-at-home mom, but she was also a sailing teacher.
Yes.
And so many of our summers were spent hanging around, you know, her and the sailing team or the sailing classes that she had.
Sense.
And so that, you know, got the early sailing going on. But also my mom was incredibly good at encouraging me and my brother to just try things. And that could be food, that could be sports, that could be activities, that could be anything. And so she was really good about just try it. And if you don't like it, you don't have to keep doing it, but trying it. And a lot of people don't choose to try things. So I give my mom a tremendous amount of credit for encouraging us to just try things. Like even back, if I think about the 1995 stuff, like I didn't know how to build a website.
Yeah.
My brother Rob didn't know how to build a website. We're like, well, I don't know, let's just try. And let's just see if we can do it. And then going back to the try it and ship it type of thing. But my mom was incredibly good about that type of thing. And as it relates to sailing specifically, my mom was the one who encouraged me to try big boat sailing. She was someone who encouraged me to try for the, you know, just try, write the letter, just ask the question.
Yeah.
So I give her a tremendous amount of credit for trying. My dad was a very good storyteller and sort of that guy that it was at the bar all the time and people hanging around listening to the story.
Yeah.
And he was an incredibly good storyteller. And if we think about our entrepreneurial journey, so much of what we're doing is telling stories either to ourselves or to our customers or to an investor. And so I still feel like I'm a shadow of my dad's skill in that category, but he was an incredibly good storyteller. Yeah. As it relates to your question about business around the dinner table, not so much.
Mm-hmm.
What was really encouraged was trying things. There was a tremendous amount of self-reliance in our house. And that could be everything from you fell out of the treehouse. Oh, you're going to be fine. You know, it's just a little scrape. Get back out there and keep trying. So there's a tremendous amount of resilience and persistence that was encouraged. Both my brother and I were very big athletes. And so athletic performance was important. And I'll probably, you know, like the story that I joke around is that my parents were really both very well read, and they encouraged us to look up things, which was very frustrating as a kid. Because halfway through every dinner, we'd be talking about whatever happened during the day. And my dad would say, you know, this, that, or the other thing. And then he would say, well, what do you think that word means? Or where do you think that came from? And my brother and I would try and hide our face and just continue to try and finish our dinner, at which point he would keep pressing on us to say, well, you should go look it up. And our house had tons and tons of books in it. And we would then spend the next whatever amount of time in whatever set of books attempting to answer the question that my dad was pressing us on. And it was very frustrating as a kid. And I know I've done a little bit of that to my daughter, but this sort of that there's an answer out there that you just need a way to try and find it. And there may be a person who knows the answer, or there may be a book that's published. And this is, you know, this is obviously in the 80s, you know, before really an understanding of the 70s and 80s before the internet. But if you look and draw it forward to help share, which was, you know, an idea that we both, Rob and I had, which is there's an answer out there somewhere. You just need a better way to go find the person who knows it and make those connections. And so in many ways, I could draw that back to, you know, my mom and dad, or my dad, again, more frustrating when you're a kid. It's like super frustrating.
That's interesting.
Like, I'm just trying to eat my dinner so I can get back to my homework. And please, can I make it through the sentence without a go look it up?
Oh, I got to look it up.
But there was a lot of that there. So those are probably the things that are more analogous or more that came from our dinner table.
That's a great story. Well, that makes a lot of sense now that I know that about your family. You know, you've helped me over the years think about how to run businesses. And one of the things that really stuck with me was telling me that a CEO needs to be curious and make decisions quickly. And a lot of CEOs don't, you know, they take their time or they hand wring. And that was always something that was a big takeaway for me. And I recently had the chance to go into PSL and talk to you and Greg and see what you guys are working on. So I'm just amazed at the kinds of things you guys are doing now and the way that the way that you're thinking about businesses. So maybe talk a little bit about what's lighting you up right now for work and the work that you guys are doing internally.
Well, as means of background for people who don't know, Pioneer Square Labs has sort of three parts of our business. So we are a startup studio where I'll spend the majority of our time. We are a venture capital firm that invests in early stage technology companies based in the Pacific Northwest. And we also work with a couple of corporate partners to help them build brand new standalone businesses. The studio itself is really a productization of the entrepreneurial experience. And can we bring all of our collective expertise and experience into a means that can accelerate the creation of new businesses and hopefully, cross our fingers, the success of those companies that we create? We have run over 400 different experiments on different kinds of business ideas to yield 33 standalone companies over the last 7.5 years. And within that whole process, there is a lot of how do you characterize an idea? How do you do ICP, VOC, EAC? How do you make decisions rapidly on a weekly basis? And by the very math, it's very clear that the majority of ideas we work on are dead, killed, because we couldn't find customer traction, because we couldn't build the product, because we couldn't find the right teams, because we couldn't find the right investors. And in many ways, when you look through a lot of our collective startup experience, all of those are reasons that companies die. They just die a lot later. And in our case, they die before they become companies. And we've built a lot of systems and tools and process and decision-making internal to that incubation process that we continue to apply on ideas that we've come up with on our own. We sometimes will find single founders, usually CEOs, who bring us those ideas. Every now and again, we find networks of people who have ideas, and then this sort of corporate alignment that I talked about, all of which are different ways to inspire the ideas. But the basic process of PSL and the studio itself runs quite consistent, regardless of how the idea is actually generated.
That framework is interesting because in light of what's happening now with AI, we talked about it a little bit previously, there's a lot of startups getting created, a lot of companies getting incubated. And I know you guys are working on your own AI tools, but being able to filter those through a lens of what is the problem, what is the use case, seems to make a lot of sense when trying to bring those companies to market.
Yeah, I think specifically with AI companies, we think that there are three different ways to differentiate AI companies. And lucky sometimes when you have alliteration in here. So differentiation could be in design. So how does the product interact? Is it a chat interface? Is it a different kind of interface? How is it designed that the end user is going to deal with the AI? Second is data. That's, I think, somewhat logical, but can you start with a unique data asset? Can you create a unique data asset? And the better that the AI itself either finds, leverages, creates, normalizes, however it deals with data, is another way to differentiate. And then third is distribution or finding customers. Is there a unique way that this particular AI that does X can find, engage, grow customers? So it's design, data, or distribution. And the distribution really ties back to that ICP, VOC, EAC structure.
Yeah.
And in that case, you can still hypothesize that, oh, I'm going to build an AI that's going to do X or Y or Z for these particular types of customers. Cool. Let's go find some of those customers. And do they really want the thing? And can we build enough of the thing to at least get early customer pull or product traction? And then ultimately, you have maybe a cross your fingers chance that the company can be successful. But if we don't have one, two, or all three of those things, many of our ideas will die. I mean, in the studio itself.
Yeah.
And many of those companies will die, right? They'll build a cool widget, but that widget, no matter how great the AI is, if it does not have certainly distribution, right? Or more likely data and distribution, and in the best case, data design and distribution, and maybe other things we haven't thought about yet to differentiate it in the market, you know, it's unlikely to be successful.
Are you able to talk about some of the projects that you're working on that Adam and Kevin and some of your talented engineers at PSL are working on?
Yeah. I mean, we have... I probably won't name them in the podcast, but we have one AI which is really focused on assisting hardware development. So for anybody who's built hardware, you know, medium scale hardware, medium complexity hardware, they almost always cost a lot more money. They always show up late. And it's very difficult to keep all the different parties on the same page as that product evolves. So we've basically built an AI engine to assist in that process where you can literally describe what the product is. It will slowly but surely write the product requirements. It will slowly help you prioritize those. It will find, using an LLM, other things you should consider. For example, have you thought about how long does the battery have to last? Oh, well, that matters a lot, whether I have a color screen or a black and white screen.
Yeah.
So just taking those two kind of requirements together, may all of a sudden you could make a choice on black and white versus, you know, color, and it changes the requirements of the battery, which also changes the price. So it's just like three things that would be part of a PRD. And then you could imagine it going downstream of, okay, now I have a product, I have some components, I have to deal with suppliers. I now, you know, supplier one comes back with something that costs $10, supplier two costs $20. Which one do you choose? And then because of that, you may have to change the ultimate price point of the product.
Yeah.
So the AI is really a co-pilot to assist in hardware design. That's one idea. Another one is all dealing with content licensing. So today, the ability for us to synthesize voice or synthesize sound or synthesize video is emerging quite dramatically. And if you're somebody who has that as IP, whether you're an actor or a musician, you really want to know who's copying you. And what do you do about that particular thing? So we have a product that's working in that particular area to both detect and then notify or compare against whoever might be the appropriate official owner of said thing.
That's interesting.
So that's another one. We have another one that is a self-learning AI. So you can basically just describe you what you want it to do, and it will not only identify what skills it needs to achieve said task, but in many ways, it's writing its own skills. So it's using large language models.
Got it.
Once it understands what it wants, to write its own skills in software, and then slowly but surely, its brain gets smarter and smarter because it acquires more and more skills, almost like a human would, but it's effectively writing its own skills and is a self-learning AI. Initially, we're pointing that toward go-to-market professionals. So people who have lots of repetitive tasks like do my battle card, do my lead enrichment, do my weekly sales report. So all those things that have some level of a playbook that have sort of a defined output or what you would call a deliverable, we can write software to automate that process. And basically, as the end user describes what they want, we look in our skills library. If we don't have the skill, we create the new skill. We aggregate skills to have a task, and a task creates a deliverable.
Yeah.
So that's another one we have. We've got another one, which is a software development intern. So similar to the previous idea, we have a capability which goes above and beyond GitHub Copilot to basically do all the functional work that a low-level software or a new internee type person would do.
Yeah.
And that can both understand the code it needs to write the code, write the test, write the documentation, check in and out the code, and even communicate with whoever their manager might be about it. So it has similarities to the previous idea, but it's much more targeted. So those are three or four ideas that we're working on in the studio right now.
Yeah, that's really cool. So, you know, as you think about on the investor side of PSL, when you have people coming and pitching you deals, there's a lot of point solutions out there, and it's starting to die down a little bit, but it felt like there was a lot of hype in the last 8 months around generative AI and chatbots. How do you think about, you always strike me as a very disciplined investor. Like, how do you think about these deals? Do you go through the 3 Ds and understand design, data, and distribution and try to weed through that? It seems like every pitch I'm sure you're listening to these days probably has AI in it in some way.
I think any pitch that doesn't have AI in it is just not going to get a look unless the team is incredible. But it'd be unlikely that an incredible team wouldn't be at least thinking about leveraging the newest, coolest technology, right? It's not necessarily AI. It's just like it is that important that anybody who doesn't have, we joke about it internally, either the whole pitch is AI on every slide, like the ones I just talked about, or effectively like every part of it is AI. Right? It's an AI high score.
Yeah.
Or there's a fictitious slide 7, which is how are we leveraging the newest, coolest technology to create ourselves an advantage? It could be distribution, it could be data, it could be the product itself. So almost everything we're seeing has at least a medium to high AI score or coefficient. Again, unless you have created like the most amazing team, like, hi, I'm a multi-time successful billion-dollar outcome founder. I'm working on a brand new toy company. Would you like to invest? Okay, it's not an AI thing, but we're going to take that meeting because the quality of the founder is so high. Doesn't mean we're going to invest, but we would at least take that meeting. The second could be, hi, I'm a first-time founder. I'm working on a toy company, and let me just show you the growth curve of how people are buying my product. Okay, that's a traction narrative. Again, still may be like no AI, but the traction narrative is so compelling. So to use another alliteration, 1 could be team, 2 could be traction, 3 could be technology. The technology is where you get into the AI category. And if you were to build a toy company today, and I just pick something that's not a technology company, probably wouldn't be Investress. But if we were doing that, then you might say, what can we build into this toy company that might use some of these cool new technologies to create a further advantage? So you may add the technology later if it's not the lead narrative. That all that said is, yes, we would still go through those 3 Ds internally and sort of talk about, okay, well, how would we get differentiation? how would we get it from distribution or data or design? Because everything you think about, like a Microsoft of the world, like they already have distribution, right? In many cases, they already have data.
Right.
And they also have lots more people to do design, but there may be ways in which you could differentiate against that sort of larger platformy kind of player. I mean, every good company that does have a solution for a particular business use case or even consumer today is adding characteristics of AI. So they already have, in theory, distribution or a set of customers built in. So you just have to have something that's more than that. Last point I'd make is I benefit tremendously by being at PSL because of the partnership that we have. So when you think about my partner, Greg, who's been a 25-year VC, my partner, Jeff, who's the most active angel investor in Seattle, my partner, Ben, who runs the Acquired podcast, my partner, Julie, who comes from Madrona as well, and myself coming more from an entrepreneurial product perspective, and that's just us as partners. When you extend it into the other 20 people who work at PSL, you have all these unique perspectives on how to think about, you know, a great investment. And we may all think about it from slightly different perspectives, but those come together when we're looking at new things. And I think that creates a big advantage for us.
Yeah, and that makes a ton of sense. Well, I mean, a lot of what we talk about on the show is AI related, but also we talked a lot about remote work and about the way that work is changing for people, not just in terms of the technology. And as you build companies and think about post-pandemic building of teams, I know you're passionate about team building. And so when you think about that in terms of remote work, being able to find people in places that aren't 20 miles around you, but also being able to communicate in ways that allow you to build great companies, how do you think about that?
Well, you mentioned Shane Mack, and Shane and I have been friends for now a long time. And we were doing work from home Thursdays at GIST in 2009. So that was part of our culture and it was part of our work process. So work from home Thursdays were naturally integrated into a 2-week long sprint that went Wednesday to Wednesday. And the first Wednesday was sprint planning. Then it was work from home Thursday. And your job was to take the time that you learned from sprint planning and come back Friday morning for stand up and say, yep, I'm really confident. I know how I can achieve over the next 2-week sprint. The next Wednesday was metrics. So every other Wednesday, we would spend our time talking about the metrics of the business and what's working and what's not. And then the opposite Wednesday was sprint planning. And then the second Thursday, so the first Thursday was, got my brain around my sprint? And do I have good commitment to each other on getting it done? So that was the Friday morning stand-up. Then you'd work all the next week.
Yep.
You do a quick check on the next Wednesday. And then the next Thursday was a work from home Thursday. You're supposed to be code complete on Friday morning. Well, everybody wanted to be like, don't bother me on Thursday because I'm work from home Thursday and I need focused time to get my shit done. That's the, I'll call it the business, in the business part of the work from home Thursday. The other part was work from home Thursdays were important because maybe you want to take your kid to school that day. Maybe you want to have lunch with your spouse on that day. Maybe you need to have a dentist appointment. So if everybody knew that work from home Thursdays were going to happen, then people could align themselves on, when did I know I was going to be in the office? Stand-ups happen Monday, Wednesday, Friday. When did I know that I was going to be work from home and therefore not bother me? Those happen on Thursdays. So everybody could build a little bit of their own life cadence into the work cadence. So you could call that work-life integration or work-life balance. And Brad Feld uses that term work-life integration quite well.
Makes sense.
Now, when we think about, I've been doing that as a leader for a long period of time. I think we did some very innovative things in a similar way at Rival IQ as we built that company. And how did we focus on an integration of work and life? And as we then move into a pandemic kind of world, I mean, we were building companies. I have one company I started. We started it. We spun it out. We scaled it. We sold it. And I never met the founders in real life, IRL, until we had a company picnic after the fact. Like that whole thing had happened.
Wow.
And I never physically met them,
yeah,
even though they were in Seattle.
That's amazing.
But as we built that company, that founder chose, because it was necessity, to hire remotely and manage remotely and build all the systems and tools to do so. So that sprint process I just described, that provides a scaffolding for remote work. when you think about the communication styles and the tooling, that provides a scaffolding for remote work.
That's it.
When you think about a written culture versus a verbal culture, that provides more for remote work because everybody knows, like, there's a document, there's a sprint plan. I know where it is. I can read it at the same time everybody's editing together, or I can read it asynchronously. That is scaffolding for better remote work. And so most of our companies at PSL today, the founders are here in Seattle. The CEO is in Seattle because they get the most out of us here at the studio. But the majority of their teams start to become remote, or I'd say remote first or remote only. And that's a little bit of the choice of the founder. All that said, it is still better to build companies when you're physically together, especially at the early days, because the velocity of decision-making is so high.
Yeah.
That the interdependence is so high and the need to just drink beer and walk around the block is disproportionately higher at the earlier stages. Like, I just can't work this thing out. I just want the time, which is sometimes social.
Yeah.
Sometimes, sometimes it's drinking beer, sometimes it's whiteboards, and sometimes it's walking around the block, or sometimes all of the above as you work through difficult decisions. And therefore, you know, our physical space here at PSL and in these early days of creating companies, I think we benefit more by being physically together. But then as we start to scale these companies out, I mean, we have a bunch of different playbooks here that are instantiations of some of the things I mentioned that we give to or encourage or support as our founders build those companies.
It seems like the scaffolding piece is the part that these founders really need to get right as they make those decisions to be remote first, for example. If they can get that stuff right, it's not as painful, perhaps.
Well, one of the things that I have a blog post I have, which is like the five jobs of a CEO. And one of those jobs is to continue to evolve systems and tools, system, tools, process.
Yeah.
I don't know whether 2 week long sprints or 1 week long sprints or 4 week long sprints is the right thing, but part of the job of the founder and the CEO is to answer that question. And if you're going to change from 1 to 2 to 4, or however you want to do it, when and how do you make the communication? Are we going to work remote or not? Are we going to get together once a quarter or not? You know, what happens when Joe's on vacation versus not? I mean, all of those things are a part of, in my opinion, the founder's job. And it's best done if it's the CEO, because the CEO has the widest level of understanding and the most amount of power to say, hey guys, I know you all want to do 3 week sprints, but we're doing 2 for this reason and we're going to keep it for this long. So part of the job of the CEO, and therefore, you know, founder CEO, is to continue to evolve and communicate updates to systems, tools, process. And this is, you know, an example of those as the team goes from 2 people to 10 to 100 to, you know, as it grows, systems, tools, process. And if you think about things like, you know, Jeff Bezos and a lot of what people remark about Amazon are systems and tools process, right? That's all
the principles.
And then like the Amazon 6-pager, 2 pizza teams, things like that. I mean, that's a systems and tools.
Yeah.
And at some point in time, they made very discrete choices, whether it was Jeff or his leadership team together. But the choices that they made on systems, tools, and process is a critical part of a CEO. My advice in general at the early stages is that you start off asking yourself that question monthly. And then once you get to 2 or 3 people, you start to make those systems and tools processes and decisions quarterly, and you probably keep it quarterly for quite a long time. And that also allows for the broader team to provide input. So they can whine about things within the quarter, but they know that at the beginning of every quarter, the CEO is going to sit down and say, like, do we like the way that we are running the company? Do we like our systems, our tools, our process? And if we don't, then here's how I think we're going to change it, or here's what we're going to trial for the next quarter. Keep your notes and we'll decide again next quarter again. So all these are systems and tools. And maybe you're starting to judge, you know, feel out of this is, you know, I'm a mechanical engineer. So as what we're doing in both building companies, but also building a company to build companies at PSL, there's a lot of engineering of the process as well as engineering of the products.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. You know, it's interesting. I have a lot of friends and I've talked to a lot of people that think about you as a trusted advisor and think about you as a mentor. And I wonder, who do you think about as a mentor as you look back on your life and career, who's really impacted you from a work standpoint?
The first one was my mom and my dad in the way I mentioned previously.
Yeah.
My brother's been a big inspiration in the way that he's thought about building products and building trust in an early founding team. And then I think I was so fortunate to meet Brad Feld along the way. And Brad Feld, who, you know, some people may know, but Brad is a venture capitalist. Brad is a very well-published author, has an incredible blog. And Brad was the first external investor in Gist. And Brad is still the largest investor in Pioneer Square Labs. And so I consider Brad a friend, and I've done lots of different roles with Brad, as, you know, me being a CEO and him being my board member. I've been on boards with him. Now he's our only external board member at PSL. And, you know, Brad has been there's a huge amount of my success I can attribute to Brad and the way that Brad thinks about things, the thoughtfulness that he brings to entrepreneurship more broadly. And, you know, I just feel so fortunate to have had the experience of working with him over whatever, I guess it's 12 or 13 years now, in many different contexts. So I think of him as a mentor.
He's had so much impact on startup business founders and investors. And, you know, when you think about some of the takeaways that Brad has given you over the years, what comes to mind?
Simple negotiation. So play for the long game. So in both the cases, when we're negotiating a term sheet or we're negotiating an acquisition, Brad has been incredibly fair. And I use the analogy of kind of a poker chips. You know, if you have like kind of a pot in the middle of the table, and here's what the cap table says, is here's what's fair. My experience is oftentimes Brad will take what is fair and push a little bit more in the entrepreneur's direction.
Interesting.
And that builds for a long-term relationship. It also means that the negotiation tends to go faster.
Yeah.
And it means that oftentimes there's not very much animosity that comes along with it. And so that would be one. Two is to pay a little bit of attention to mental health as well as the business health. So Brad's been a very outspoken person around mental health and entrepreneurship and mental health. And you mentioned sort of the way to build a company and the who's showing up when. And you know, Brad's also a big runner. And so I've tried to integrate athletics and physical performance and mental performance into the entrepreneurship work that I have. And then last but not least is really teaching. So Brad, you mentioned myself as hopefully being an advisor or mentor, you know, to other entrepreneurs. You know, I take a lot of that from Brad, but productizing it in the form of a podcast or a book or a blog post, and then teaching and sharing is another means by which he's been an inspiration to me, and I'm trying to do more of that myself.
That's great. Well, I always like to end the show asking a question around, what do you think about, how do you answer the future of work in two words? You can elaborate, but if you were going to choose two words to explain the way that you think about emerging tech in the next 5 to 10 years and the future of work, what would those two words be?
It's a great question. I think it's very difficult to put that in two words, but I'm going to attempt to do so. One is going to be learning, and the second is going to be diverse.
Okay. Elaborate.
And learning in the sense that we are at this point in time in technology where we are all having to experience like a whole new way of thinking about building companies. And that can be on a lot of axes. Could be the AI axes, could be many of the things we mentioned. It could be remote versus local. And we are all going to have to be very, very open to learning a lot of new things in a ways that makes us sometimes feel uncomfortable, which good learning often does.
Yeah.
So learning is one. Diverse overlaps into that because there are going to be a whole set of skills that we didn't think about combining, which become very, very important in this near future. And that could be, hey, we're working in a global level. Therefore, I need to understand how I interact with people all over the world. I need to understand how I interact with people from lots of different contexts. There's certainly the diversity, equity, inclusion narrative, which is important, but I broaden the diversity too. When you think about a future where maybe the programming language of the future is called English, maybe that's how you make products. Okay, that's very different than the way that we thought about before. And if so, do we have to learn how to speak differently? Or maybe we have to think about the fact that everyone around the world is building products in different ways for global audiences, and therefore diversity in thought, diversity in background, diversity and understanding and appreciation is very, very important. So learning and diversity.
Love that. TA, thank you for taking the time today. I always get something out of talking to you, and this was a wonderful conversation. I appreciate the time. So thank you for being on the Shift AI podcast.
Thank you very much.
That's a wrap. Thanks for tuning in. Such a pleasure to have TA as our guest on today's episode. TA's knowledge and experience founding and exiting venture-backed businesses and his stories about sailing and the future of AI were fun to explore. If you want to learn more about TA, you can find him on LinkedIn and Twitter. If you're interested in how he thinks about venture investing in AI startups, definitely connect with him and keep up with his posts and activities online. I continue to be amazed by the guests we've had on the show, and I'm excited about the ones joining us in the near future. Truly appreciate you spending your time with us. Thank you for listening to the episode, and don't forget to subscribe to the Shift AI podcast for more exciting interviews, and to the Simply AI weekly newsletter for updates on how AI can help you scale your business. The Shift AI podcast is produced and sponsored by Simply Augmented, and our theme music was created by Dave Angel.